Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A vote in the state Senate last month tanked a deal to use Wisconsin's budget surplus for tax refunds, special education funding, and more.
That proposal was negotiated by Democratic Governor Tony Evers and Republican legislative leaders, but the bipartisan plan met bipartisan opposition as all Senate Democrats and three Senate Republicans rejected the plan.
Now, the top Republican in the state assembly wants to bring some kind of deal back to the table.
Assembly Speaker Robin Voss joins us now. Speaker Voss, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on. Good morning.
Earlier this week, you told Upfront, Speaker Voss, that you want to work with Governor Evers on a revised plan. What are you hoping to accomplish?
Well, number one, I think that, Wisconsinites are so divided like much of the country. Anytime that you get 80% of the people agreeing on something, we should at least give it our full-throated effort to try to find a consensus that everybody can live with. So here we sit in Wisconsin. Look, we have concerns about school funding. We know property taxes are too high, and we certainly need to do more to help people deal with the ravages of inflation, right? So when a Democrat governor and a Republican legislature negotiate in good faith, it should have been something that everybody just signed off on, saying, wow, I can't believe the two sides who normally don't get along very well are showing leadership. And that's why I guess I'm an optimist that people in Wisconsin want us to do something. They don't want us to just sit back, leave the money in Madison, where we certainly aren't going to do any good for the state. So, look, if there are other ideas, I am all aboard. Look, I was disappointed that our Senate Democrat colleagues didn't even offer an amendment. They didn't say, here's a way to make the deal better. Here's what we can do to try to showcase that they're willing to lead as well. So I want to give them another chance. Look, they had said they were concerned about the deficit. We now know some of their initial concerns really weren't well taken. We know that the deficit that would be projected is way lower than the one that we voted for last year. And we've had two increases in revenue, one $1.5 billion in January because of the growing economy, and the second another $300 million increase just from where our baseline was. So even by investing the surplus in the no tax on tips and overtime, more funding for special education and property tax relief, we still have a sizable surplus going forward. And that's where we should all be proud that we can come back together and figure it out.
That 80% you mentioned, the results of a Marquette University Law School survey. Now, getting this back on the table would be the challenge for you at this time. Have you heard from the governor? Is he open to going back to the table on this?
Yeah, it sounds like the governor is willing to work with us again. I know I talked to the legislative leadership in the assembly, and I've reached out to those colleagues in the state Senate to say, let's come back to the table. Look, we are all paid to do our job through the end of the year. There is no reason that we don't come back and try to deal with this surplus in June. Look, school starts in the fall. We know people are going to be setting their property tax bills, and we can deliver significant relief before we adjourn the legislative session. So, in my mind, again, no reason not to, especially with this newfound money. We need to get it back to the people.
A big stumbling block, though, is the Senate would have to come back and do this. Senate Minority Leader Democrat Dianne Hesselbein said she talked to your colleague, your counterpart in the Senate, Senator Devin Lemieux. She says she's not hearing a lot of signs that this would come back, that they're going to come back and vote on anything. What would you say to your colleagues, your Republican colleagues in the Senate, to get them to come back into session and tackle something here?
Well, first of all, I've been talking to senators, Republican senators. They agree we should come back, that there's no reason that we let this money sit in Madison when families and school districts need it. So I think the consensus sometimes takes a little longer to generate in the state Senate than it does in the state assembly. But I guess I'm an eternal optimist. This is one of those rare times, again, where both sides came together, they negotiated in good faith, we have a package that the public supports, and we need to show the people of Wisconsin that when times are tough, people step up to actually get the job done. We've done it a lot in the past, and I am confident we can find a way to get it done this summer.
Assembly Speaker Robin Voss is with us. He's making a last-ditch effort to pass a plan to use the state's budget surplus for tax cuts and school funding, among other things. Last week, Speaker Voss, I talked to State Senator Chris Kapinga, one of the Republicans who voted against the plan. Here's some of what he had to say.
Eventually, actually in the second budget cycle, all of a sudden, the taxpayer in this deal, because there's perpetual spending put in place, would all of a sudden have to be going to their pocketbook again and be like, wait a minute, I thought this was a great thing because it gave me a bonus. I got cash in my hand, and all of a sudden the cash is gone, and they have to continue to pay this bill.
So Senator Kapica saying, hey, this is perpetual funding based on a one-time surplus. You said the deficit numbers weren't as bad as critics made out. What would you say to Senator Kapica and his two colleagues who voted against this?
Well, it's really disappointing because I thought Senator Kapica was smarter than what he's sounding like in these interviews, because we know that we do a two-year budget cycle where we do projections of revenue and projections of expenditures. The expenditures have basically been in line, and the revenues have been ahead of our projections. So why would we want to keep that money in Madison when we have the opportunity to give back extra money that we do not need back to the taxpayers? Number two, the relief that he's talking about, the reason we want it to be permanent is because if somebody earns overtime or tips or they want property tax relief, we don't want it to be one time, because that property tax bill or their income tax bill is forever. So why would we not want to find a way to have permanent tax relief that, again, keeps the money out of Madison so we don't spend it on growing government and lets people keep it in more of their pockets? I thought Senator Kapica was a Republican, and that's the basics of what we do as Republicans, which is to try to make government more efficient, drive efficiencies into the system, so at the same time we can give the money back to the taxpayers. That's why I ran for office. I think it's most Republicans. That's why we're there.
Would you be open to changing the deal to make it more focused on that, the one-time stuff, less ongoing things, to get those votes you need to get this over the top in the Senate?
I mean, I'm always open to listening to good ideas, so if they have a way to do it, of course we're willing to listen. But again, the idea of saying we're going to have ongoing spending, which is really what is required. So if you have special ed, as an example, where we would take it to the highest level, in Wisconsin history, well, if we're going to do that, we're not going to do it one time and then cut it back later. So if we're going to have spending built in, which it should be to help school districts with the increasing cost of special ed, I don't want to say that the tax cuts are one time so that we have permanent spending on schools but not permanent relief for families. So, yeah, I mean, I'm always open to listening, but it seems like the deal that we had, which was fiscally responsible, balancing the needs of school districts and taxpayers, is a pretty darn good one. I haven't really heard anybody make a case why it shouldn't be permanent, knowing that our revenues are increasing, we have a sizable surplus, and the needs are real.
Now, Senator Kapica, I've heard this from other lawmakers, Speaker Voss, also questioned the process here. The sense was, hey, the governor and the leadership in both chambers met up. They came up with this deal, came to the rank and file and said, here's the deal, take it or leave it. They wanted more input. They wanted more back and forth on this. What do you say to those concerns?
I mean, Senator Kapica spends a lot of time out of state, so perhaps he wasn't at some of the caucuses that they had. But I know Senator Lemieux came to us and said he had been working with his caucus. I had worked with our caucus in the assembly. That's why I think everybody but one member voted for it, because they knew it was in the deal. They knew it was a good deal for taxpayers, and it was important to make some of these strategic investments. I believe they had the exact same conversations in the state Senate. So if he didn't know what was going on, that's because he chose not to attend a caucus or get involved in the process. That's not a fault of Senator Lemieux or anybody in the state Senate. It's individual members who did a good job, I think, of communicating where they were. The three members who voted no said they had to have a sizable rebate in order to support the deal. That's why we actually put that $300 and $600 rebate for individuals and couples into the bill, to be able to say, hey, we listened to what they wanted, and then ultimately they kind of reneged on the deal. I don't know why they would have.
Now, you're not running for re-election. Neither is Senator Devin Lemieux, your counterpart in the Senate. Neither is Governor Evers. Now, an uncharitable observer might say, hey, these guys want to go out on a high note. They'll be out of office before the financial impact hits the state, especially if there's an economic downturn. Those revenues aren't as rosy. We might regret some of this spending. Do you feel like this plan is really a fiscally responsible way to wrap up your career as Speaker?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I am proud of the fact that when we inherited the majority, we had massive deficits, no money in the rainy day fund, and, you know, literally a fiscal crisis in the state. We've solved that, and now every session that we've been in charge, we've been able to reduce the tax burden because these surpluses keep piling up because of prudent, fiscal, responsible leadership. There's no reason not to. And I think the last thing that's most important is most of the people who voted for this deal, you know, in the assembly, it was Democrats and Republicans. Most of them are running for reelection. They wouldn't have done it if they thought it was a stupid idea. In the state Senate, the only people who really voted no were two people not running for reelection who've been a no pretty much on everything in their entire career. And Senate Democrats who cynically want to use it to spend on growing government next time. I think this is a perfect opportunity for us to say, let's strike a middle of the road deal. Money for schools, money for taxpayers, all out of the surplus, so we can show that Wisconsin actually works and that we can find a way to get to yes, as opposed to just what people are sick of, which is politicians posing for holy pictures and getting nothing done for real people.
One critic of the plan was U.S. Representative Tom Tiffany, the only candidate on the ballot for governor for Republicans. The hope there, I might think, like with a Republican governor, maybe you can get a better deal for this. Do you think that Republicans should hold off, hope they win that governor's office and get a deal more to their liking?
No, I mean, the people don't say, let's wait around and see what happens later. I mean, I understand Tom Tiffany's point that when he's governor, we're going to do it differently. But Tony Evers is governor for the next 6 months, and the legislature that we have is the one that generated the surplus. So we certainly should try to get it back to the taxpayers as quickly as we can. Look, when Tom Tiffany's governor, and God willing, we have a Republican legislature, they can sit and figure out other ways to give the money back to the taxpayers. And I'm sure I would support every one of them if I was in the legislature. But people don't want us sitting on the money and waiting for a future time to cut taxes. They need help now. Look at the price of gas. Luckily, it's coming down a little, but it's expensive for families. We see the cost of food and rent and property taxes. All of those are a burden now that we want to help with the surplus that's been generated over the last couple years, not waiting for a hope that something's going to be different next time around.
In our last 20 seconds, it's an election year. It's June. Is it realistically too late to accomplish anything at this point?
You know what? It's never too late if people of goodwill want to sit at the table and find a way to get to yes. My hope is that, like we've done in the past, we sit around a table, we find an answer, we keep our colleagues engaged, and we're able to get it across the finish line. We've done it before. We can do it again.
Speaker Voss, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
That's Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, Republican from Rochester, talking about the possibility of reviving a plan to use Wisconsin's budget surplus for things like tax cuts and school funding.
Up, UW-Stevens Point runs one of a handful of sites that test restaurant packages and other materials to make sure they can be composted. The lab director shares a new expansion project and why their services are in high demand.
We don't risk the generation of methane from their biodegradation, and we actually sort of begin to close the loop on that packaging cycle.
That's next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. When you eat at a restaurant and your take-home container is labeled certified compostable, what does that actually mean? And who verifies that it will actually biodegrade?
Well, a lab at UW-Stevens Point does that.
There's interest nationwide in making food packaging more compostable to cut back on waste. And states like Washington and Minnesota have put standards in place for composting some packages.
The Wisconsin Institute for Sustainable Technology at UW-Stevens Point is one of 8 labs in the country able to certify these products as BPI compostable. That BPI certification mark indicates a third-party verification that, yes, it can be composted.
And the certification lab at UW-Stevens Point is expanding. They've recently added new testing equipment and capacity, and they plan to add home composting to the mix.
Paul Fowler joins us now for a look at the science behind the project and the research going on here in Wisconsin. Paul's the executive director of the Wisconsin Institute for Sustainable Technology. Paul, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Rob, it's my pleasure.
Now, the Wisconsin Institute for Sustainable Technology has been around, I think, since 2010, but you've got a big change now. What has happened with your lab setup?
Right. We're at the culmination of an 18-month project, which has been to relocate 3 labs, which were in 2 buildings on the main campus, into 1 world-class, state-of-the-art facility on the north end of the UW-Stevens Point campus on Maria Drive. So we have a facility now which consolidates all those otherwise dispersed operations.
And in the old setup, was it a thing where you might start a process here and have to, walk or drive it to the other end of campus?
No, you're absolutely right. So we would start a process on the third floor of the Trainer Natural Resources building. We would then take it three floors down on a fairly precarious lab cart across a parking lot, whether it was raining, snowing, ice covered, into another building and then down another floor into the basement of the science building. And that operation was quite precarious and also a little nerve-wracking since some of the materials we were moving were the culmination of 3 or 4 months of work. And just one mishap on that cart would cost us, at least 4 months of work.
Now, you're one of just a handful of labs around the country who do this BPI compostable testing. What is this BPI label? What does it mean?
So BPI stands for the Biodegradable Products Institute, and it's a national organization and it has a presence in Canada as well, which certifies products, materials, packaging, food service ware as being industrially or home compostable. And so our lab does all the sort of technical due diligence on manufacturers' products to enable them to work with BPI to put a logo on their products, which lets a consumer know that the products they are buying are compostable.
And what kind of products do you do work with mostly at your lab?
So we work with a lot of food service ware items. So that's things like knives, forks, spoons, paper cups, plates. We also work with food packaging and food waste caddies. So if you're familiar with maybe wanting to collect food scraps and composting those, a number of manufacturers are making bags which make it easier to collect those food scraps and then transfer the bagged scraps to a composter. We also test other sort of food packaging materials, pouches for coffee beans, for example. We do sandwich bags as well. So anything which is kind of coming into contact with food or is being used for handling food.
And this is a big concern. I mean, obviously, we have a lot of packaging in this country. With COVID, I think there's a big explosion in takeout, right, from restaurants and all these services that will you don't even have to drive there. They'll deliver it to you. And there was concern, right? Are we generating a lot of landfill waste with this stuff? So the compostability of this stuff is a pretty solid environmental concern, right?
Exactly. And I think that's really what's driving the a movement towards more compostable packaging materials. They really provide us with another option for disposing of packaging at the end of its useful life instead of consigning those materials to landfill. We can divert them into composting operations where they actually degrade in a more environmentally benign way. We don't risk the generation of methane from their biodegradation. And we actually sort of begin to close the loop on that packaging cycle. Lots of these materials are made from renewable materials. And so they start their life being made from renewables. And if at the end of the life, we can return them back into a system which can then be used to grow new materials, it kind of closes that loop.
I want to walk through the process, Paul. So my company, Robco, comes to your lab, said, hey, I've invented this great new to-go soup container for delicious soup from my favorite restaurant. It's got the base of it. It's got the lid. I want to get this compostability label. What do you do to beat up my product and see how it's going to work?
So you've actually got two products there. You've got the cup and the lid, so we're going to need to test those separately. But what we do is we take a product through a whole series of tests. We talk about compostability testing as if it's one sort of item, but it really comprises three really distinct tests. One is disintegration, which is done to understand whether a material sort of physically falls apart in a composting environment. And that's so that if this material goes into a composting environment, the composter it wants to be certain that when he composts a product, that it's not going to be present as litter, as contamination that he could see. And so from that perspective, that disintegration test is really important. And that's a process that takes 12 weeks. And that's not the end of that particular story for that compost. We then take the compost that results from that 12 weeks experiment, and then we germinate and grow plants in it. And that's to make sure that that finished compost that is in, that has got the composted packaging material in it is not going to harm the growth of plants, because nobody wants to buy compost that isn't going to grow their plants, right? And then there's another component, which is around biodegradation testing. And that is probably the most sophisticated test that we do, in the sense that we expose a test material in a compost environment for a period of up to 6 months. And over that 6 months time frame, we continuously monitor the evolution or the production of carbon dioxide as the microbes present in the compost actually metabolize or eat the packaging materials. And so what we're doing there is quantifying the effect of microbial action on the packages to show wow. that we're converting them ideally to 100% carbon dioxide from the starting materials.
Now, I know there's been concern over, you know, some kinds of waste material we've used, cleaned up, put on farm fields or whatever, then later find out there were some kind of pollutants in there. PFAS is a recent example. When you're mm-hmm. breaking these materials down, are you looking for those unwanted byproducts?
You know, we do that even before we start to break them down. So I said that the compostability testing is really a suite of tests embedded within that sort of umbrella. And so we do some material characterization at the very start as well. We look for regulated metals. We quantify the amount of any fluorine, regardless of its source within the materials as well. So that would not only capture PFAS, it would capture any sort of sources of fluorine that might be present either intentionally or unintentionally within the product as well. So the tests that we do are really stringent from the perspective of proving, as I said, that physical breakdown, biological breakdown, do they harm the plants, and then really characterizing pretty fully a chemical fingerprint of the materials, any regulated metals that might be present, and fluorine too.
We're talking about a composting lab at UW-Stevens Point. It tests products for their ability to break down and then be good for plants and the environment. Paul Fowler is with us, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Institute for Sustainable Technology. Paul, I don't have a company that makes packaging, but I used to have a really good compost bin in my backyard, and one brand of chips billed their packaging as compostable. And I tried it. It didn't compost in my backyard composter. I'm guessing, like in a commercial or municipal one, the conditions might be different. Do these packaging materials do different things maybe in somebody's backyard composter versus a fancier operation?
You're absolutely right. So there are really two distinct routes or two distinct labeling programs that are beginning to operate. And probably the most, or definitely the most well-established one, is industrial or commercial composting. And that's where an operation has set up to make compost as a business. And those organizations, those businesses, are managing their compost piles with a view of generating revenue from those. So they're really managing their piles in a very sort of strategic, well-managed way. And the consequence of that is that they're controlling the moisture, they're mixing or turning the piles to aerate the systems, and that process kind of generates heat as the microbial action takes place. And the heat is can be quite high as well, 140, 150, 155 degrees Fahrenheit. And so that chip pack that you referred to earlier was designed for management in an industrial or commercial program. Home composting typically takes place on a much smaller scale. I'm not going to comment on your management skills, Rob, as far as your home compost pile is concerned. But typically, those piles might not be turned as frequently or managed quite so closely as a commercial organization. And so the temperatures are maybe not as high. The management is not maybe as quite so active as well. And so there's a different sort of set of circumstances that exist in home than would in a commercial operation.
Now, you work with companies around the country making their packaging, wanting it to get tested and certified. I understand there are at least some in Wisconsin. What can you tell us about the Wisconsin companies you work with?
Yeah, there are companies all over. So we work with companies right the way across North America. But right here in Wausau, Wisconsin, we work with a packaging manufacturer called Roastar. And they're a really neat, innovative company that makes packaging materials, particularly for fresh roasted whole coffee beans. And so they've developed some really high performing packaging structures that preserve shelf life. They allow the fresh beans to degas once a coffee bean has been roasted. They sort of emit CO2 slowly. So if you think about a coffee pouch or a coffee bag, they have a little valve in them. Sometimes you squeeze the bag and you can sniff and smell the aroma of the coffee inside, but that's to let CO2 escape. So Roastar has got all these different components of a really sort of sophisticated coffee bag, the zipper and the valve and the bag itself. Great from the point of view of shelf life, keeping the beans fresh inside. But the added spillover benefit is that those materials, we're demonstrating them to be industrially compostable too.
You are at a lab attached to a university, right? I would have imagined this would be just a standalone commercial operation. At Stevens Point, do students get to play and be a part of these experiments?
Great question. We are an integral part of the university. We're a program of the College of Natural Resources here in Stevens Point. We had a long-term student intern. She graduated just a couple of weeks ago, but I think she had and I hope she would tell you the same, a great experience just learning the real world challenges and just the satisfaction of taking a range of products through this whole process. And over that period of time, I think she got some real good hands-on skills that I hope she takes with her and benefit her career going forward.
UW-Stevens Point, I think it's fair to say, is known for natural resources and sustainability. Is that part of why this lab is there in the first place?
I think it is. We started doing this before compostability became trendy, if you like. And I think it's really a testament to leadership within the college, leadership at the university, that they supported our endeavor even before it became trendy or the next big thing.
I understand your next step at the Institute is more focus on home composting. So what's going to be different about testing products for home composting? I guess that those temperature gradients you mentioned are part of it, versus the commercial and industrial uses you're looking at now.
Yeah, we touched on that a little bit. So the difference is really the temperature at which we do the tests and the length of time for which we carry them out. So I talked about a 12-week period for industrial disintegration. That extends to 24 weeks for home composting. Biodegradation studies, which are 6 months in the industrial context, are 12 months in the home context. And so it's a slower process, but the tests that we do are no less rigorous. It's just more time consuming. It means that we need to put in more space, more capacity to be able to do home composting as well. And that then enables a good consumer like yourself, Rob, to have confidence in the products that you buy that they would be home compostable as well.
Is this going to be a situation where the BPI label, for example, might say certified for industrial composting or certified for home composting, or is it going to be that fine-toothed on that distinction?
It will be that fine-toothed, and that's important from the sort of a regulatory standpoint. As companies want to make claims, they need to be real, real specific as to whether their materials compost in an industrial or a home environment. So that regulatory aspect is really important, but also just from the perspective of letting the consumer know what they're getting, that's also really key too.
And consumers may wonder, like, how they may want to be more responsible, not pollute, things like that. Mm-hmm. Where do they look for these labels if they've never looked for them before? How do we spot them? What do they look like?
Yeah, they're going to be on pack. So quite a distinct little circle with a leaf growing on it. It'll say BPI certified or And it's going to be on the package where you would maybe see other sort of environmental labeling as well, like a how to recycle logo, that sort of thing.
And then you've got the home composting project coming up. What else is out there in the research world or open questions on composting that you'd like to either tackle yourself or see someone get into?
So we sort of track what's happening around the world as well. We're really testing right now to US and European standards. We're seeing interest in how the incorporation of packaging materials into compost impacts the life cycle of worms. So adding worm testing is part of our future plans as well. We think just that the amount of testing and the load of testing is only going to increase as folks become more familiar with the products. There's going to be more scrutiny of them, and the scrutiny is already real high, but we think that those it never goes back, right? Things always get more and more detailed, and we think sort of testing animal life like worms is going to be something which is on the horizon too.
Paul, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Of course, you are very welcome. It was my pleasure.
That's Paul Fowler, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Institute for Sustainable Technology at UW-Stevens Point. We've been talking about their composting testing and research that they do there. Hey, home composters, want to hear from you. You proud of your compost bin? I used to be before I had to move and leave it behind. Or is it still a difficult technology for you to master, as it was for me at first? Let us know. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Coming up, the Milwaukee Brewers held some early morning games during World War II so that factory workers on the night shift could catch a game. A new children's book honors that history.
They had the team's manager wearing pajamas, and they carted him out on a four-post bed onto the field and then, you know, woke him up. It was like a little skit.
The author of Baseball for Breakfast is next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The Milwaukee Brewers are off to a great start, leading the National League Central Division. Baseball has had a long, special place in Milwaukee.
But during World War II, many people couldn't attend the games because they worked the overnight shift as the city converted its factories to make weapons and machinery for the war effort.
At that time, the Milwaukee Brewers were a minor league baseball team, and they came up with a solution: baseball for breakfast. Morning games were a way for the city's second and third shift workers to still go to the ballpark.
And Baseball for Breakfast is the subject and title of a new illustrated children's book. Maggie Carroll is the book's illustrator. She's based in the village of Heartland near Milwaukee. Maggie, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
And Judy Campbell-Smith is the book's author. Judy, welcome to you.
Thank you for having us. Thank you.
Judy, you don't live in Milwaukee, but I understand that you're a big baseball fan. Where did the idea for this book come from?
Yeah, I don't live in Milwaukee, but I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago, and that's kind of how I came to this story. I was reading about the history of the White Sox, which is my team, and Bill Veeck was once the owner of the White Sox and also at another time of the Milwaukee Brewers. And I just read this line in his bio about morning baseball games during World War II, and it really sparked something in my imagination. So that kind of led me to look into more about this story.
Yeah, the team's owner, Bill Veeck, at the time, he was such a promoter of baseball. What ideas did he come up with to make baseball fun and more accessible for fans at Borchardt Field?
Yeah, he would try anything. So he was doing giveaways, but he would, not like today, he would give away like giant blocks of ice or live livestock and living animals. And he would have like live music, which we don't really see that much anymore at baseball. So he was a real showman and just tried to do anything to make it
fun and exciting for fans.
What were you able to learn about how the team started playing baseball in the morning?
It was great to find some historical records of that and some stories from people who were there. And so they did the games in the morning, and we know that they served breakfast foods. So they served cereal and coffee and donuts. In not every game, but at least one game, which is what I feature in the book, they had the team's manager wearing pajamas, and they kind of carted him out on a 4-post bed onto the field, and then, you know, woke him up. It was like a little skit. So it was just a really unique thing to have baseball going on in the morning, but then they really leaned into the theme.
I just love that moment in the book because it is so corny, and yet, you know, it is historical as well.
Yeah, I love the quirkiness of it, that it is just this thing that could only have happened maybe in the space and time, but it just brings out all the fun.
Maggie, you're from Wisconsin. What was it like to illustrate a book about your home state?
Yeah, it was a really fun opportunity because I was able to do a lot of research and learn more about my state and see like historical photos, which is really exciting for me.
What was it like for you to, illustrate this book? What did you use? What did you draw on?
For the illustrations, I did a lot of research. One of the illustrators I looked at was Eric Revillius, who's a British wartime artist. So incorporating that historical inspiration was really fun. And I looked a lot at his use of line work over color and how he uses a lot of framing. So that was a really exciting influence to integrate.
Can you describe your favorite illustration of the book, if you have one?
Ooh, yeah, I really liked, well, a lot of them were a lot of fun to draw because I got to draw a lot of people and exciting scenes. But I think my favorite one was the scene showing Pop going to war and Ma dressed up for like the factory. So I just like drawing like all the different scenes on that spread and emphasizing like everyone working hard during that time.
Mm-hmm. Judy, what made you think, you know what, this would make a great children's book?
I think that's just how my mind works. I'm always kind of looking for little bits of history that I can turn into stories for kids. That's kind of my favorite genre. And with this story, when I came across it, I was like, okay, there's baseball, which I love. So I'd been wanting to write something about baseball. It had World War II, which I felt was just an interesting time of history, but it also had this very fun aspect to it. So it wasn't like a sad war story. It actually is very joyful. And so all those things were just, to me, felt like there was a possibility to make a book for kids that was set in this time period, but also about baseball, but still fun. So I think it came together, but it is, yeah, kind of a strange way to go about it for kids.
And we get a glimpse of this family who loved baseball as well. This is minor league Brewers of the 1940s. And you created a fictional Black family around this team. And you created, you know, the father is fighting in the war. The mother is working nights in a factory. The son is missing these family outings to games and all the things they did together when they went to these games. What are you exploring through this family lens?
Yeah, I think it is a family story. It makes something that was happening to all kinds of families, not just white families, but Black families all over the country where this was happening. Parents were going off to war. Parents were switching up hours and things like that. And for me, when I was growing up, all the World War II stories were about white families and white soldiers. And that is definitely a huge part of our history. But I was proud to be able to show a Black family because this was also a reality for Black families and brown families during the war. And I was inspired by my grandpa who did serve in World War II as an electrician. And so to me, it just felt like a way to put my family history into the book, even though it is a fictional family. It does represent my family, but a lot of families.
So, yeah, I mean, you know, your grandfather, Roger Smith, and then in this book, Pop joins the Navy. And, you know, I feel like it is, in a way, a bit of a tribute, do you think?
It really is. And that when I was coming up with what was going to happen to the fictional family, it just, when I realized, like, oh, I can make him go off to war like my grandpa and serve in the Navy, it just felt like a very special way to pay a small tribute to him. And then even just to get his, to mention his name in the back matter, I feel like that's something that is just going to be really special to my family for years going forward.
We sometimes have the image of, like, for women, of Rosie the Riveter with her sleeves and her muscle, but she is white. And so you also have this Black woman going off to these overnight shifts in the factory.
Yeah, I would like to say I love the way Maggie illustrated all of that. She did such a wonderful job. But I just love to see a Black woman represented kind of as that Rosie the Riveter figure. The Rosie the Riveter image is so iconic and inspiring. But again, it just captures one part of the reality. And so there are, you know, there were Black women, brown women, you know, all types of people who were serving in this war effort. So it was great to just show that representation for kids, that this really was something that everyone was impacted by, and a lot of people were sacrificing in different ways to serve through this time period.
We're learning about the new children's book. It's called Baseball for Breakfast, about how the Milwaukee Brewers played some morning baseball games during World War II. Judy Campbell-Smith is the book's author. Maggie Carroll is the illustrator. Maggie, did you learn anything about Wisconsin in working on this book?
Yeah, I learned a lot. Just seeing like pictures from that time period was completely new to me, because I've seen pictures from like other like states and stuff, but seeing more like specific to Wisconsin was really exciting, as well as like learning about like the Brewers, because I didn't have any knowledge about that time period for them. So that was a very interesting for me.
What do you like about illustrating for children's books, Maggie?
I really like to draw exciting things, or like try to come up with like fresh things for children's books. I really like incorporating research, but trying to make it like fun and exciting for kids.
Judy, how much do you collaborate on the direction of Maggie's art, or did you trust her to just run with her ideas? How does that work?
Yeah, it's actually kind of funny that you asked that, because this is the first time Maggie and I are talking together in children's books. Quite often, the author hands over their written work to the art director and the illustrator, who kind of work separately. So we really didn't collaborate directly. I did send her some notes and research that I had, some photos that I thought would be helpful. But I think it's amazing, because one reason why I loved her work, it just felt right for the time period. But I feel like somehow there's that cosmic connection where Maggie just really found exactly the heart of the story and the right tone and colors for it. So there's certain pages that I when I saw them, I'm like, that's exactly what I wanted, even though I hadn't told her what I wanted. But I think that's just a really wonderful talent that illustrators have, but especially Maggie in this book just really made it just, I'm so happy with what she did. It was just, yeah, really a big gift and privilege to have her illustrate my story.
I wonder what jumped out when you know, what did you think the first time you saw her illustrations and saw them next to your words?
Oh, it's just an exciting moment for an author when you get those first sketches and you start to see it. When I saw her work before she started working, the publisher sent me like samples of her previous work, and I just felt it had the right energy to it. I'm not an artist, but just it felt right. It looked a little retro, but also still fresh. And so when I saw the pictures that she had done for the book, I was just like, yes, I had the right instinct about her. She just was perfect for it. And seeing the colors that she chose for things, and just seeing
the characters come to life. It's just so exciting, and it just feels like, yeah, that I couldn't have picked a better partner for this.
Judy, is it hard to come up with ideas for children's books? Do you get the feeling of it's been done before, or do they flow pretty freely for you in terms of ideas?
I think for me, ideas are really easy. They come all the time. A lot of them are bad. a lot of them have been done. Or when I actually write them, it's like very boring. But I get ideas all the time, and I'm just trying to land on the ideas that are going to turn into a really unique and compelling story. So I feel like I'm always getting ideas from everything that I see and inspired by things in history, but things my kids are doing. Everything is inspiring to me, but it's the creative process of kind of searching through all those ideas to figure out which are really worth pursuing is a fun part of the process to me.
What is a good writing day for you?
It really varies. I have another job and I have kids who are now home for the summer. So a lot of writing days are actually writing nights for me. That's maybe when I can write. But a good day would be if I can get a few hours, maybe when the kids are at an activity or at school, and I can just focus on the story or focus on research and feel like I'm making progress on something. But I don't necessarily have like a writer's schedule right now that's always the same or consistent. It's kind of mom life a lot of the times, but still being able to get those moments and work in those hours is always nice.
Maggie, what does a good drawing day look like for you?
I try to draw every day, but I usually, try to draw like all day, but then there are like stuff like emailing or other types of like market prep to do. But yeah, if I finish one drawing in a day, then I'm happy.
Do you find yourself sometimes starting over with drawings, or how do you know when you've got it right, that you've hit it?
Yeah, sometimes it's like frustrating when the drawing doesn't work out, because I really want it to work, but then when I realize no matter how hard I keep trying, it won't work, then I have to restart. And then, yeah, there's like a certain feeling, or I feel like building on that drawing, like, it's going somewhere. So, yeah, that's how I know.
Well, Judy and Maggie, thank you so much for joining us.
No, thank you so much. It's been really fun to talk.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was an exciting opportunity.
That is author Judy Campbell-Smith and illustrator Maggie Carroll. The book is called Baseball for Breakfast, a mostly true story. It's based on historical events when the Milwaukee Brewers hosted morning games during World War II, so people working overnight shifts in factories could still enjoy the games. Judy has a book event and reading set for June 27th at Wauwatosa Public Library. It's at 11 a.m.
As we just heard, the children's book Baseball for Breakfast features a family during World War II that loved to go to Brewers games together.
And along those lines, let's hear about the kind of games your family likes to take in together. What sport does your family love to watch? Do you go to baseball games in the summer? Have you started a tradition around a favorite team, past or present? Rob, your family has a tradition of going to soccer games, is that right?
Yeah, we turned out to raise a couple of soccer players. We went to lots of their games, of course, but we went to see lots of games locally, some around the country. In fact, they're a little grown up now, but we're going to see a game this Thursday with them.
Love it. Email us your story at wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text us at 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Beatrice Lawrence, Mackenzie Crummy, and Joe Tarr.
Our technical directors are Jeff Robbins and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.